Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is...
Neat!
It's a weekly booze cast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Neat.
I don't know.
Okay. I liked it.
Thanks. Thank you for your support.
Great job.
Thanks. I want to say before we get started on our topic this week, I have some corrections, mainly on one of the things that I said, which was that the name of the patron saint of beer is actually pronounced Hildegard von Bingen, not Bingen, as I pronounced it before.
It seemed too good to be true. I get it.
Yeah, right. No, one of our listeners was so kind to tweet at us and give us that correct pronunciation. And she also helped me out with the pronunciation of her own name, which I also butchered when I thanked her for tweeting about our show. So thank you to Marile, and if I fucked that up again, I'm very, very sorry.
All right.
Gave it my best shot, but thank you so much for sending us that correct pronunciation. Also, I did talk a little bit about the lack of women-run and gender nonconforming / trans-run beer operations, and some of our dear listeners tweeted at us to let us know about some really cool organizations. There's the Pink Boots Society for Women in Beer, which Becca Ackland, who is a member of that org and is one of our listeners, told us about. And there's also the Queer Brewing Project, created by Lily Waite. And that project launched their first beer, Queer Royale, back in April of 2019, earlier this year.
Nice.
So, they collaborate with beers and breweries and raise awareness about queer issues in the brewing industry. So, and they donate a portion of their proceeds to charity, which is cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And we'll definitely put information on where to find these on the internet.
Yeah. I'll totally put those infos up there.
Cool. All right. So this week, a lot of you wrote in. Do we have
There was names? Someone who did write to us on Patreon. I think that some people early on might have tweeted us. Well, I'll have to go back and see if I can find those. Okay. But we did have somebody who wrote to us on Patreon. And that is... Oh, okay. So this is a question from Stella Sewell. And Stella writes, Hi, I have a question. Mead is my favorite drink, but you can only really buy it in specialty booze stores. And I've never been to a bar that served it. But it's not like it's an obscure drink or anything. So I'm curious why it's so commercially unavailable. We're talking about... Mead.
And yeah, so we're gonna tell you all about the history of mead this week, along with some other tangential topics.
Yes, mead and mead adjacent topics.
Yes. So I'm gonna go ahead and jump right into it. First off, and most importantly, what is mead?
What is it?
Well, very simply, mead is made from fermented honey in water with yeast. It's usually in like more modern times made with white wine yeast. In the past, it was an ambient wild yeast.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds sexy.
But three basic ingredients, it's all you need to make mead. It's sometimes called honey wine, but it exists in a category of its own, much like cider, with its own unique history and production methods. So it's not a beer, it's not a wine, it is its own thing.
All right.
Yeah.
Independent spirits. I like your attitude.
Of course, the next question would be, what does it taste like?
What does it taste like?
Well, you know, despite what you may have encountered at your local Ren Fair, which is where most of my mead encounters have come from, it doesn't have to be sweet. It has about as much variety as really any other entire category of spirit. It can have, like, it can range in alcohol content from as low as, like, 4 or 5%, like a light beer, to as high as 20%, like a fortified wine.
Oh, wow.
And even above that, if you remember the term jacking alcohol
from
Applejacks.
Oh, my God, yeah, okay.
So you can actually jack, and a quick refresher, that's freezing it and removing the ice to, like, drive up the alcohol content.
Mm.
of a spirit, like they
jack it up.
You can jack up meat. Sorry. That's all right. it becomes something called honey jack. So you can even get almost like basically like a liquor strength spirit from mead.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Body wise, it can be everywhere from flat, slightly effervescent to entirely sparkling. It can have added carbonation. It can be light. It can be refreshing. It can be thick and full bodied. So really all across the gamut of bodies on this.
So there's no like standard for what a mead has to be.
Nope. It can be anywhere from bone dry to sweet as hell.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And then as far as additives go, it can have flowers, herbs, fruits, spices. It can be served young. It can also be aged in barrels. And yeah, so for anyone that thinks mead tastes one way because you had it one time and think it's one thing, that would be about the same as like trying like a dry champagne and assuming that that's what port tastes like because it's wine.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It is as differential, if not more so, than wine or beer. I mean, and that's not even getting into the fact that like the individual honeys that you'd use to make your mead provide vastly different flavor profiles.
Yeah, because all like honey, depending upon what the bees had for like got where they got the nectar, like from clover mm-hmm. or wildflower or whatever, that would make the honey taste different even.
Exactly. So when we talk about like how much differential there is in wine from the different flavors in the grapes, that's just like you could make that comparable to the honey, but that's not even countering in all these other additives and differentials that I've talked about. So it is a whole category. It is a whole body of spirits.
That's exciting.
Yeah. All right, so now to get into the history.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where does it come from?
Well, it's arguably one of, if not the first spirit fermented like liquid that we ever encountered.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's also one of the most widespread. It developed independently around the ancient world. It goes by many names around the world, but our word mead comes from Old English and more or less means sweet fermented drink.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, like, pretty much, like, as long as there's been bees.
As long as there's been bees, as long as there's been honey. I mean, the oldest recorded traces of mead come from pottery found in China dated around, like, 7,000 BC.
Ooh, that's old.
But even before that, the kind of fabled origin story, and this is definitely a fabled origin story for mead, is that an ancient person stumbled upon a beehive that had been, like, waterlogged, like, so it was full of water, and the honey left over in the hive had kind of fermented in there, and this person was like, I'm gonna drink that.
why would you see that and be like, I'm gonna put that in my mouth?
I mean
sounds
guess
good.
There wasn't much to do back then, so I guess drink some bees, like no,
like oh my god.
This is like a lot of like, I mean, this goes into like culinary history and definitely in booze history. You stumble upon something that in modern times, I'm like, whoever would put that in their mouth? But somebody did, and that's why we have it.
Right. Somebody tried it at some point and decided that it was worth doing it again.
Yeah. But so you know, thank you for whatever ancient person decided to drink from a waterlogged hive.
Some old bee water.
Yeah, it was great. It was, yeah, dead bees floated in it, but whatever. It's great.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so morbid.
So you've got the, you know.
I will drink from the blood of your ancestor bees.
I guess it probably smelled nice. It's like, not like all fermented things we've made. That's like, oh, that's just like honey fermenting. But then moving forwards from China, it's discussed in ancient writings from India, dated to like 4000 BC. Of course, the ancient Greeks got involved in it because they got to be involved in any sort of booze making in ancient times. And, you know, you hear the phrase like nectar of the gods or ambrosia. They're talking about mead. They actually believed the dew gathered by bees to make honey descended directly from heaven. Of course, also, we've got Pliny the Elder, because he's going to get involved in this.
Of course.
Famous Roman medicine man. He recorded mead, and he specifically felt the need to record the difference between mead and honey wine, which at the time was just wine sweetened by honey.
Ah, yeah. Big difference.
The Vikings drank mead before and after battles, so to give them strength and to celebrate.
Yes.
And of course, in the epic old English poem Beowulf, there's a mass consumption of mead by the Danish soldiers.
Did you have to read that in sixth grade?
Everybody had to read that.
We had to go see the movie. When the movie came out.
Oh,
we
that's
had to
cooler.
Go see the movie.
I shouldn't say that. Isn't that cooler to see the movie?
I mean,
than
it was. It was a movie, but it was still Beowulf. So, you know.
Well,
take whatever you want to take from that.
Do you remember mead drinking in the movie?
I mean, I was 12, so I didn't really get to, like, get Register. Excited all about right. that.
Well,
they were, like, drinking things out of horns and shit.
That's probably, they were probably drinking mead.
They were probably drinking mead. Absolutely.
Well, and it's part in, like, art and poetry and myth kind of extends to all the way up through modern times, but certainly through the ancient world. I mean, it was considered a divine beverage through Celtic and Germanic poetry as well. And of course, when it comes to mythology, there's mead involved in a lot of myths, but I do want to touch on one of my favorite.
Okay.
It comes from Norse mythology.
All right. Vikings?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. They're fun.
So this is there's this fabled mead of poetry or like mead of intelligence or of the scholarly. And it's this mead that if you drink it, you'll become like wise and impassioned and brilliant.
Or at least you'll think you have.
Yeah. But the myth comes from like, there's a lot of detail here. I'm going to make it like real short for you.
All right. Give me the cliff notes.
Okay. So a bunch of Norse gods were at war. They came to a truce. So to mark the truce, they all spit in a pot.
As you do.
As you do. Like, all right, we're all going to get along now. Patooey. And from that spit, they made a little man.
Of course. Why? Why not?
It's a little truce man.
a little truce spittle man.
Yeah. So there you go. Wow. So they got weird ways of working out the differences. So this guy.
Is God spit that thick?
I don't know. I don't know how. I mean, I've never personally encountered it. But this little spit dude, he traveled around the world, like, sharing knowledge with the masses until he ran into these, like, couple of dwarves that were total assholes. They killed him and,
oh, no.
Yeah, and mixed his blood with honey. And that's where they created this mead of poetry.
Gross.
Right? The story goes on from there. There are giants. Like, Odin gets involved. It's wild. But blood isn't usually a common ingredient in
no.
mead. No. So gods got in a fight. They got over it. They made a man from spit. And then some dwarves got involved.
Is this where the gingerbread boy story comes
what?
From?
That is a wild...
They made the little man come to life, and then everybody was trying to eat him and kill him.
Well, I don't know if he was, like, actually little. I think he was just little compared to, like, the big old guy.
Oh, okay,
like,
that makes sense.
He's just, like, a human.
That makes sense.
But
all
anyway,
right.
Yeah,
that's
so...
That's also a morbid story, by the way.
That's a weird...
The gingerbread man. Oh. The real myth is... Not myth, you know, story. It's a story. Fable.
Oh, okay.
It's morbid.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a fucking... Doesn't he kill the fox?
I don't know. Why are you asking me clarification on this?
Guys,
you
look
just
it
had
up.
A lead in and then you're like, well, can you tell me the story that I just let into?
I'm sorry.
No.
I thought this was... It's like among like grim fairy tales. Like, it's
no,
like...
Okay. No,
okay.
I don't know the story.
I don't... Well, I clearly don't know either, so... Look it up. I'm sure it's fucked up.
All right. Well, less fucked up.
Okay.
Than apparently the gingerbread man is. So our term honeymoon comes from mead. In medieval times, a bride and groom would be given enough mead to last one whole moon cycle because it was thought that drinking it all during that time period would bring them luck and fertility.
And loosen you up because back then you probably just met your... betrothed.
Yeah.
So, you know, you gotta get...
Well, and I will say, cause like, in research, that's one of the more fanciful associations with the term honeymoon. Honeymoon has some dark
understanding. Oh, there's darkness, too?
There is, because, like, it was also, like, you know, when you would just, like, steal your bride and hide her away.
Ooh,
and, like...
that's right.
It's either the family didn't find her in time, and now she's pregnant. Oop, she's yours now. Like,
oh, yeah,
so
you're
honeymoon
right.
Honeymoon has a whole lot of Yeah. There's levels to it.
So, like, best case scenario, you just met this person and you're going to go on a trip and drink a lot of booze.
Yeah. Hopefully best case by scenario. Choice. Yeah. So we're not going to go into the dark history of honeymoons. Okay. That's a different podcast.
I guess it is.
We're just going to say, hey, mead. Hey. All right.
So the mead is cool. That's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, it was hugely popular. It was enjoyed in cultures around the world. You know, where did it go?
Where did it go? I mean, I think it's still around, right?
Well,
or did it leave and come back?
I mean, I will say to note, like, it's still, like, honey fermented beverages continue to be popular in other parts of the world. We're just kind of talking in a Western sense where it's not really on our palate.
Right.
A lot of things went to contribute to sort of the downfall of mead, kind of coming to a head around the 1700s and 1800s.
Okay.
One of the first was that, like, I mean, honey was hard to get. It was expensive to harvest. Yeah. And this is going up against when agriculture gets more and more refined. So things like grains and grapes are becoming way more easier to make.
Right.
Where we didn't really advance our ability to plant bees. Like, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I mean, yeah.
So beer and wine becomes easier to make. Honey stays kind of a hard, expensive thing to produce.
Right, because first you got to make the honey, and then you make the mead.
Yeah.
And honey is hard to produce in itself.
Well, and you know, I mean, this time, like, we're talking about a time when it's like, honey is protected by bees. We didn't have, like, great beekeeping, like, equipment at the time.
Right.
So you just kind of had to get you just stung.
Wore, that's like when the ladies wore the big hats and they just put the black fabric over it. And you just like, you just talk to the bees while you're harvesting the honey. Mm. Like, oh, bees, I'm going to tell you about the wedding that just happened. Please don't sting me.
Yeah, you have to distract the bees.
That's where telling the bees actually comes from. You have to tell them an interesting story so that you can steal their honey.
That is. You don't have to distract grapes or barley.
It's true.
To harvest them.
They're pretty complacent in their harvesting.
So yeah, so you've got, it's way easier to make beer and wine. It stays about the same difficulty to make honey. But then, I mean, on top of that, just like, fermenting honey in like a widespread sense, when we don't really have an advanced knowledge of yeast strains, honey is proven as like antibacterial to antimicrobial.
Oh yeah.
So because of this, you have to have very aggressive yeast strains to ferment honey.
Oh.
I mean, when you talk about like smearing honey on like wounds in ancient times, that wasn't a terrible idea. It's not as good as like what we have now, obviously. Get some Neosporin, don't use honey, but like
we have options now.
But there are certain properties to honey that make it a lot harder to ferment than competing substances at the time.
I never thought about that.
Yeah. And then to kind of put everything to bed, sugar becomes more and more readily available and kind of becomes the cheaper go-to sweetener, replacing honey. And new taxes are put in place that drive up the cost of honey and mead and make it less, like reduce the profits so drastically in mead that, you know, wine and beer just become the obvious choices.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, but mead is coming back now.
It is. It's kind of like the next generation of, you know, we had the craft beer movement. We had, like, more awareness towards wine and like natural wines. Cider has kind of had its time, and mead has sort of developed alongside of that. And it's for, you know, a lot of reasons. Like, we have just more of an interest and an education available towards like craft spirits in general. Also, there's a bigger focus just in like health communities on like local honey and its health benefits. And that can go that can be used in other venues.
Yeah.
So more money going into the pockets of people that make like craft and artisanal and organic local honeys means there's more money to do things with that honey.
Right.
But yeah, like, you know, meaderies have started to work their products into high-end restaurants, expensive cocktail menus. They've popped up more and more in like boutique wine stores. And I mean, even in our neighborhood, like,
yeah,
there are like two local meteries.
Oh my gosh, we just went to one today, which is so cool.
We just went to Honey, which is the tasting room of Enlightenment Wines.
Yeah.
We also have here in Brooklyn All Wise Meadery, which is run by Dylan Sprouse. That Dylan Sprouse of The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody and other things, but like, yeah,
but mainly of The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody.
So, you know, like, one went on to be Jughead, the other went on to make mead. Either way, they're winning.
They're doing good. Yeah. You know, they're doing great.
Yeah. So it will probably never topple beer and wine in marketplace settings, because it ultimately is something that has to be made in a very, like, artisanal way. Mm-hmm. You know, mass-produced mead isn't really a thing.
I feel like that's a long way away.
Yeah, and I think for good reason. But
that's part of the charm of it too.
Yeah, well, and I mean, it's cool that it's out there and it's more, like, more readily available, because it's a very tasty glimpse of our history as humans.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, you're drinking something that has been enjoyed by every generation of humankind.
Yeah. That's pretty special.
Yeah. So, if you see that waterlogged beehive on the ground, just try some mead.
Or maybe just get some from your local meadery or look around. So I will say, the thing that I am going to talk about, although it wasn't because of the issue that I'm about to talk about, it did coincide with mead and the disappearance of bees. So it kind of just, like, it, like, with, like, the craft mead movement, it's a very small movement, but it is happening. They're using this to bring attention to the fact that the bees are endangered now, because you can't have mead without bees.
We gotta save the bees.
You gotta save the bee. And, you know, A lot of mead makers, or mazers, which is a fun thing that mead makers are called.
It's a good term.
It's great. I love it. A lot of mazers are opting out of using the cheaper imported and commercially produced honey, number one, because that honey is not as good and would produce, like, lower quality mead. And number two, because that cheap honey is really bad for bees.
Hmm.
So harvesting honey isn't actually really that bad for bees if you do it responsibly, because bees have hoarding instincts, and sometimes they'll produce too much honey. And if there's too much honey in the hive, then that causes them to be honey bound, in which case the bees will either have to leave to search for a bigger home, or the honey will overflow into the part of the hive where they raise their young. So it makes it impossible for the hive to raise future generations of bees.
So graphically, they drown their young in honey.
Yeah. Or they just stop reproducing.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those. Wow, I want to see an episode of Hoarders that's just bees.
That would be the most adorable hoarder.
I can't part with any of my honey. I love it all. I need a Sherman.
Oh my god. So beekeeping, actually, when done ethically and responsibly, means that there's a mutually beneficial relationship between the beekeeper and the beehive. Bees give their excess honey, and in return, the beekeeper takes care of them. They make sure they're safe and happy and have plenty of sources for nectar, which is really important, because nectar is it's not just like sugar. It has nutrients in it because it comes from plants.
Mm.
The problem is, as with any factory farm type situation, when you're commercially producing an animal product, you typically go for quantity over quality. And as a result, those animals, and often the human workers involved as well, have a lot worse quality of life. And in some cases, the honey is over harvested, which is not good for the bees. They need some of that honey. They eat it. Like, they, of course, like, they're regurgitating the nectar, but they feed it to the larva. So, like, they need the honey to keep the hive going. It's not just like no, oh, this is an extra thing we made. There's no purpose for it.
Like, why did we do this?
They're using it. The bees do use some of the honey. And sometimes in commercially produced honey, they use pesticides, which is not good because obviously the bees, being a small creature, would be susceptible to be damaged by a pesticide. And also sometimes in the winter, instead of feeding them nectar, they'll just feed them sugar water, which is like, because it doesn't have nutrients in it, it's essentially like starving them. Or like, you know, like if you had like 500 adopted children and you only fed them McDonald's, you know,
it's, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's, yeah.
So doing beekeeping the right way requires a lot of patience and attention. So like, you know, I mentioned pesticides. So like pests like parasites or fungi can invade the hive and you have to do something about it. But like you can't really, if you use chemical pesticides, then you're going to hurt the bees too. So local beekeepers and beekeepers who do like a natural method of beekeeping will actually have to take the slabs out and remove the fungus or the pests by hand, which is like, you know, it takes some time and care. And even responsible honey harvesting takes a lot of care because you don't want to displace the bees. Like there's a lot of things, there's a lot of things related to like bees and stress. Like they feel, they're very sensitive to their environment. So if they're stressed out or confused, like their production isn't going to be good. So the product that you're going to get from them is not going to be good either.
Right.
So when you're harvesting the honey, you don't want to displace the bees. So they do something really fun, which is this sound, like I was a little alarmed when I read about this, because what they do is they smoke the bees out of the hive, but like it's not
they smoke them up.
No.
They smoke them out.
No, it's not like
they get those bees super high.
That is one way to think of it, because they don't
get those bees chill.
It's not like an aggressive smoking. Okay. They don't smoke it so the bees are like, oh my god, the hive's on fire, get out of here.
That seems like a stressful thing.
Yeah, no, they gently smoke the hive, and somehow this relaxes the bees and they calm down. So you can take out individual slabs and you use a special bee brush to brush them off the slab, and you have to do this as like a special way so you don't hurt the bees, but like they're so calm that you can just flick them off and they won't swarm. Like they won't get upset about it. They're just like, oh. Just like, great. Imagine a bee like gently being lifted off of a honeycomb.
All right. Okay. As long as the bees aren't hurt, I'm down for that.
Yeah. So like, it's like to smoke them, they use like a chemical-free source, like fuel source, like cotton or leaves or something like that. You also, when you go to take the slab, the frame of the hive, because they basically like in a beekeeper hive, they have like sliced up frames of the beehive so they can remove them and put them back.
Right.
And so they'll take one slab and then you have to carry it wherever you're going to extract the honey. It has to be like far away from the beehive because the bees might follow you. And if they follow you, then it's like there's a risk of them like going into the honey extractor and getting crushed, which you don't want because you want to save all your bees that you have. You're responsible for these bees. You don't want to hurt any of the bees. So, yeah, you know, because the bees are endangered, so we don't want them to get crushed. We don't want that. So supporting these local beekeepers that take so much care into taking care of their bees is really important. So one meadery that we know of that is being really active in this is actually the one that we visited today, Enlightenment Wines.
Nice.
They're based in Brooklyn. When they talk about their honey, they buy their honey from a beekeeper in Western New York, who is primarily a honey producer raising bees to produce unpasteurized raw honey. And a lot of bee farmers actually make their money by moving their bees around for pollination. Right. So they'll like a lot of bees are brought into California,
yeah,
because they need to pollinate those, which is like, that's good. Like we do need bees for pollination of crops and stuff like that. But this process of moving them around actually stresses them out a lot because they get confused. So the honey then that they make is not as good. So the beekeeper that Enlightenment Wines uses doesn't move them around, keeps them in the same place, because relaxed bees make better honey, which makes better mead. So meaderies have a really good reason to invest in local bee farms. So Enlightenment Wines makes a point to invest in beekeepers that use natural methods, and they feel that this is the best way to support the bees and the beekeepers in general.
Sure.
I will say it's unfortunate, but local beekeepers can't really keep up with the demand for mead. So we can't get all of our mead made from honey from local beekeepers. Some of them do use imported honey. A lot of meaderies still are making a point to be ethically sourced. So they will get their imported honey from TrueSource certified apiaries. So it's imported, but it's ethically sourced. And since saving bees is actually, it's a worldwide issue, so it's okay to get honey that's sourced international. But if you're not buying local, you want to make sure that it's verified. When you buy mead, you know that they typically had to use quality. I mean, they have to use quality honey, first of all. Like, you're not going to get a good mead if you don't use quality honey. So the chances are high that the honey was ethically sourced, and you can always research the mead and the meadery to find out what honey they used and where they got it. So chances are when you're drinking mead, you are helping the bees. I will say one bummer.
Oh no, you're going to end on a bummer?
I won't end on the bummer. We're going to talk about it a little bit more, but like, I just have to say there is a kind of mead out there. I don't know if you can buy it commercially, but some people make it, and it's not nice to bees. It's not kind to bees at all. It is called whole hive mead, and this is the method that Vikings used because people think that this is a higher quality thing because it's a, like, this is one of those cases where they think that because it's an ancient ritual and it's how primitive humans did it, then that somehow makes it better. But really, I would say that this is one of those cases where we probably didn't know why the fermentation process happened and thought that it had something to do with magic, so we had to do it this way. And so whole hive honey and whole hive mead is made by actually just fermenting the whole hive with the bees inside. So you boil the bees, and it's not very nice.
I don't like that.
No, I don't like it either. I don't want to try it.
No, never. Well, and I mean, you know, this whole topic for me, like, I follow a vegan diet. vegans get mad at me on Twitter sometimes because I think that there's, you know, it's important to be ethical with your eating. I think it's important to be kind to animals with your eating, but that's a personal choice that I've made. But I do think in the case of honey, it gets a little complicated because bees are endangered, and we live in a capitalist society, and having a product like mead that gains from having bees treated well and having local sources, like, the popularity of good mead that's made correctly, you know, it behooves the beekeepers to have healthy, happy bees.
Right. Like, nobody's making shitty mead. Like, nobody is investing their time in making low-quality mead.
Right. There's no, like, Bud Light of mead.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, like, just crap that's made that's, like, mass-produced. It's, like, it's such a, like, a niche thing where it's almost, like, it's good to support. I mean, it's the same thing with local honey. Like, and you can always talk, like, especially with, like, local honey, you can talk to the people that make it, and you can find out that if they're treating their bees ethically.
Yeah.
Because I think if, like, you know, you talked about things being honey locked.
Yeah. Honey locked or honey bound is when the bees make too much honey, and then, like, sometimes they just die. Sometimes, or they leave. And, like, when I was looking this up, like, I found in, like, my internet search, like, some questions came up, like, my bees are leaving. Why? And, like, that's what happened. And displaced bees isn't good for bees either. Like, it's not like, oh, yeah, no, they're going to go, it's better for them, they're going to leave and find someplace better. No, they're going to have to leave and start over, and it's going to be hard for them, because, and their chances are they're just going to die.
Right. Well, and that's like the fact that there are people out there that have a lot of beekeepers that have a lot of concern about, I know how much honey my bees need to survive. I'm only taking what they produce extra.
Yeah.
I'm saving it so that if for some reason they do get light during the winter, I have enough to give back to them. Like,
right. And they know the percentage that they're supposed to leave.
Right.
Like, responsible beekeepers, and it's in the beekeeper's best interest to not take too much honey because the bees need the honey. So they're going to start dying if you take too much.
Right. Yeah, and that, you know, it's being aware and asking for the knowledge and definitely buying local. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the key, like talking to the people that make it and making sure that you're getting a product that is ethically sourced, because it is a time where it's like, as much as I get the argument, like, just let bees live naturally and let's not interfere with them, we kind of can't turn back the clock before we were harvesting bee-based products. So
yeah, because we kind of fucked up. So it would be really irresponsible for us to stop intervening now.
Just set them all free and just, yeah. Like, they at this point, it's better to, I think, support operations that are focused on having happy, healthy mm-hmm. bees. And you know, if you have capital to spend on such, on luxury items, which not everybody has, but on local honey and mead, like making sure that you're giving your money to people that actually are then turning that money into the bee healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we don't just want those bees to get their numbers up. We want them to be happy. We want them to be excited to be in this relationship, you know? Like, we want happy bees. Right. Happy, safe, healthy bees. So
yeah. look into, you know, if you've never tried mead before, if you've only had it and it's like a super sweet, like, mass-produced Renfair form, there are,
oh my god, there's a whole world out there.
Yeah. And I mean, look it up, like, it's amazing.
We even tried, like, I think tonight I tried four or five different meads, and they were all so different. Mm. They were all so different. And like, I mean, even one of them, like, I mean, I like kombucha, and I like immediately drank one and was like, this tastes like super sweet, yummy kombucha. Like, you know, that's not everybody's flavor, but it's not the only flavor of mead either. Like, mm-hmm. there's like a lot of, there's a lot of different flavors out there, and try some mead.
And if you want to, after we're done here, we're going to kick over to the video and we're going to actually make some mead cocktails. We got a nice, like, hopefully something that's similar to what you can find more readily available in like a nice wine shop. We've got a mead that we're going to play around with that we're going to use in some very familiar cocktails. And see how it plays.
Right.
So, Stella, to answer your question, hopefully that little bit of mead info was cool. And as to why it's so commercially unavailable, it's just a supply and demand thing. There are more and more every day local meaderies. I think, you can seek those out. They're definitely popping up. It's on the rise. Actually, a lot of the articles I read said that Game of Thrones helped a lot because they drink a fair amount of meat.
Of course, yeah. It's in.
But yeah, so, you know, like I said, I don't think it'll ever become a massive player in the marketplace, but maybe that's okay because it should stay something that doesn't become something that exploits bees. It should stay something that supports and protects them. And I think that the day that that changes is the day that I would have to rethink how I feel about it as a consumable quantity.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's great. So thank you to everybody who tweeted and retweeted about the show this week. It really helps us a lot. And so really quick, that list is Sam Bishop, Ashton, Zeewee, Marile, Foz, Dorothy Hoover, Purple Worm, Austin Wills, Tommy Smurl, Ashley, Stella, Mary Smurl, Sydney McElroy, Adult Diaper, and anyone else we missed, thank you so much. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoozeCast. Thank you if you sent us suggestions of where to go in Salem. That was really cool. Shayla Fitzpatrick told us to go to Bit Bar, and we had a lot of fun. So thank you. Oh, we love Bit Bar.
Those vegan nachos.
Right? And Janie B told us we should go to Danvers, which is the old Salem Village that had to change their name because they were too scary.
Right, yes.
We wanted to visit the place that we wanted to go, the Rebecca Nurse Homestead, had some weird hours that we couldn't. And we also didn't want to, like, rope some innocent Lyft driver to drive us somewhere haunted. So we didn't get a chance to check that out, but we did read about the history and we were thoroughly creeped and spooked. And thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and give us a review. Don't forget to head over to our YouTube channel. We're about to meet you there tomorrow, probably.
Yes.
Is when you'll get that video. Yep.
All right. Well, I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been Neat.